So that's where we left off last time. So we will realize this additional bit that comes with the transactional extensions to the cache management by just adding the letter T to a cache line in case that it takes part in a transaction. Apart from that, we track whether a CPU has entered transitional mode, well, in our head or something, I don't know. But it's not explicitly found on the diagrams there. So what we see here is an excerpt of the example that we had for illustrating the transactional access a few slides before. And it's just the part that is inside the body of the conditional branch that is executed after the transaction started successfully. So in the beginning, we can assume that both thread A and thread B are in transactional mode. So both of them have already entered that. But that just means that it has backed up the internal registers and initialized the counter appropriately, which we'll just assume as happening behind the scenes. So we enter straight in the part where we are within the in the body of the transaction. So yeah. What else is there to say? CPU is assumed to have the exclusive value of the variable. Well, it's data IDX, but as that is a pretty long thing, I've just marked that as D. So that is there in exclusive mode in cache of CPU A and in cache of CPU B, it is considered as invalid, and store buffers, well, there may be things in there which don't interest me, so but for that example, there's no store contained for variable D. So yeah, let's just see how that might work. So, first of all, that is the event with which we start. So here what we do is we access the memory at position D. So for that, we check the memory, and turns out that store buffer doesn't have anything in store for us. There's no pending write to D, and also there's the memory line is just an exclusive state, so we can directly return 5 as the value for that and don't change anything in the state of that line. Fine so far. Then let's assume that thread B is working on the same thing. So this one has is also trying to read D, but there's nothing in store buffer, and we have an invalid state of the cache line for D. So what will happen is we will issue a read message on the MESI bus, and that just goes out there and will access that thing. So we'll go to one thing that I missed was having a read during transaction in transactional mode over there, adds this thing to the transaction. So after that, we should go over to a new state, which is transactional ES. So we have, not S, it's 5. So we have recorded that that is part of the transaction. So now we issue a read to that. And, you know, what's happening when thread A or CPU A is recording a read message on a transactional variable? Well, that doesn't interfere, at least not directly, with the transaction. So what we will do is we will go over to a transactional, still a part of the transaction, but now it's not exclusive anymore. Instead, it's shared. So we have shared 5. And the read response here will be shared 5. And since also CPU B is part of a transaction, the cache line is also marked as being part of a transaction. That's not the same transaction as the one from the other CPU, but as thread or CPU B is also in its own transaction, it has its own cache lines and its own transactional state there. So that's for that. So you see, if we only have read accesses during transactions, we have there's parallelism possible there, as long as the only kind of races on the same variables are in read mode, the transactions don't abort directly. So there's concurrency happening. Then let's continue with the thing. So thread A will now perform its computation. Temp is considered to be something in the registers, so we don't track it in the cache lines. Instead, what we do is we will write to the store buffer, which will introduce a new value for D, and well, I don't know what the actual value is, so I'll leave it open. I haven't specified what value should actually be, but doesn't matter for our purposes. We don't perform the actual calculation. We want to show. We want to have a look at how the communication actually looks between those things. So, for the other CPU, we have also an access to the cache line with D is modified, and so we enter the thing in the store buffer. And now the question is, which of the two CPUs store buffer is the first to access the MESI bus? So that's completely open. Don't really know. As that's a queue, it might depend on what other things are actually in the queue and some other things that we can't really know. But what might be is that CPU B is the first that accesses tries to empty its store buffer and thus tries to invalidate the address for the cache line for D. So what it will do is issue an invalidate, and this one will go to the cache line over here. I haven't modeled an invalidate buffer here, but that just depends on what the concrete architecture is. In that case, we don't have something like that in our system. And having a transactional cache line that receives an invalidation request will then just lead to not only an invalidation, but also, well, I don't know why the dependency is like this. I'm not sure about that one here. Well, it's from that side, but in principle, so let's just remove that way. Sorry? D is where the thing is detected, but it's a little bit. We could maybe do it the other way around, like that. So the store buffer is somehow also something that needs to be modified. So we drop the change to variable D. But also what has to happen there is that we will have to revert the values from the register set, and also we have to reset the counter and reset the instruction counter. And that all together is a little bit difficult to somehow model with these things. So maybe we'll do something like Thunderbolt or something. So here we get a reset because of a failing transaction. Nevertheless, what we can send out is an invalidation acknowledgement such that the store buffers, the lines. I actually need to remake the slide, I think. It's actually communicating with the store buffer first and then going to these lines. So it's going like this and then back up over here, and it goes through without hitting this one. So I think that was the way that we modeled the whole thing. It's a little bit questionable what I did here on the slides before, but So that would be the way that the thing is then carried out. So we have a T modified, and I don't know the actual value, and I don't care. It's just what the computation would give us. And yeah, after that we will at some point reach the X end, so the transaction succeeds, at least if it's able to clear all the flags, and that's well, there's nothing happening to prevent that. So in the end, we will get a modified state there, and the value is still the same that we had before, and yeah, with that, the execution can just simply continue on, and the other CPU will restart its transaction. Yeah, it's maybe worth noting that, of course, it could be the case that the other transaction just restarts, so that might then throw the transaction from CPU B also out of its ordinary execution and go to its fallback path, and yeah, well, both of them might need to redo their computations, but that's just not a situation that we can observe over here. So it all depends a little bit on how the surroundings are and what the actual executions are. But as far as the instructions go that we see here, that is what we can observe. So, is there any questions on the transactions in the on the cache line level? Yes? So the question was whether each of the threads, well, they called thread there, but they're dispatched on the CPU, and each of the, well, the cores in that sense would have their own register sets and their own facilities to back them up and also count the transactions. Yeah. So they do have. Good. So that is something that gives rise to kind of an emerging pattern that that deals with how with ways how to access restricted transactional memory and have a fail-safe fallback path. Because in principle, all you need to do is kind of replace these parts of the code with just your particular critical section of desire, and then you're done with that. So, but if you have to manually duplicate your code, that's always a bad idea. So the idea would be to somehow come up with a way to get the benefit from restricted transactional memory and still be somewhat comfortable in specifying the code. So the idea for that would be not to not to directly duplicate the whole thing, but instead go over to a version of update where you only once specify your critical section, and apart from that, somehow deal with the switching between transactional memory features and the features from standard locks in separate functions. And that's what you'll see over here, where we now have this lock and unlock method, which is supposed to have the or carry the part of the switching between those two principles. Thus, we should probably use different colors to highlight those things. So for lock, we would need this part over here. So it should this should somehow carry at least try to access the transactional memory feature and integrate the part where we would check for other executions of the fallback path as well as the correct handling of the fallback path itself. And we should also have the code that is then either ending the transaction in case that the transaction has started, or the epilogue of the standard locked section of our critical section handled in one thing. And yeah, that's the purpose of the unlock. So how does that work? The lock would be implemented this way. So we would start the transaction as usual with just the xbegin, and in case that the mutex is not available, we would then just issue an X abort, and with that go over to the wait part. And in case that the mutex actually is available, we would directly return, thus jumping over the wait part. Yeah, apart from that, there's the unlock, which should then do the exact same thing. Not the exact same thing, but the counterpart that is needed for that. So, in case that the mutex is in use, we would then signal for other fallback executors to be able to enter the fallback path. And in case that it was not used, then I must have reached that unlock through the hardware transactional memory path. So I need to end the transaction in some way, and that's what we can do with the XEND. And if we do it that way, we can access hardware transactional memory in a pretty similar way as we have done with standard locks. The only thing is that we would have implemented something like a fast path through the whole system, where we would rely on the transactional memory to do the management of the conflicts and try to enable as much parallelism as possible. And only in case that there's an actual conflict happening, we would revert to a locked implementation of that. And that is a principle that is called lock elision, because in principle we could actually access execute the critical section of our code without actually taking the lock at all, because this lock method might just revert to the transactional memory feature and not need it wouldn't need to actually establish the taking of the lock, and would also be able to end just without ever touching the lock at all, well, except for a read access, which might just be not interfering too much with our system. There's no need for invalidations happening between all the cores. We can just read from that. And in that case, we would circumvent or elide the actual lock. So that's lock elision. that as soon as the it turns out that the CPU or the thread is just not actually alone in trying to execute the critical section, turns out that there's conflicts, then in that case the whole system would revert back to a non-transactional solution. And that would be just realized with an ordinary mutex. So that, of course, as that is some kind of a way that people can use transactional memory in the same way as they are used to locking mechanisms, the idea was, well, wouldn't it be nice to just be able to somehow retrofit old implementations in a way that they can just comfortably use hardware transactional memory without too much fuss? And that is where hardware lock elision is playing a role. In that special pattern that in which you would use this hardware transactional memory, as that is something that is pretty similar to a construct that we have already. We might also think about just providing special hardware support in our implementation of transactional memory, where we would try to optimize what's actually happening there. And that is what hardware lock elision is actually about. So let's focus on what that is actually giving us. It's a way to provide execution support for having protected critical section without the need to actually have a real concrete lock communicated throughout all the participating cores. And what's needed for that, or what's provided in order to achieve that from the hardware, are these two additional instructions, X-acquire and X-release. Those are the two that I have already introduced or indicated that they would be offered a few slides ago. And you can just equip your former lock-based implementations with these things that act as kind of prefixes to the instructions that are relevant for your locks. In particular, that would be these compare and exchange things that were the ones that were necessary for implementing locks. And if you prefix them with these X acquire and X release things, you can trigger the hardware lock elision in these cases. And these opcodes are made in a way that on older platforms they are just not having any effect at all. So the old or the older platforms would just execute the ordinary fallback code, which would be lock protected anyway, just with standard locks. And if your hardware happens to support these X acquire things, then everything would go or try to use the hardware elision features before the standard locked version. So, for that to work, of course, all these signal weight operations that work together need to be annotated with these new prefixes, but that's a matter of libraries. So, in order for implementing, what is offered from the hardware now, additionally to standard hardware transactional memory, is there's a new box, which is kind of an enhanced store buffer. And in the store buffer, we have now also places where we can put the elided locks in. And these are kind of very, very fast accessible things. So we don't really need to introduce cache lines for our lock data structures anymore. They are explicitly kept in there. And what's now the deal with the new instructions? Let's have a look at them. Exacquire would ensure safe exclusive state of the cache lines that and it would issue an xbegin and store the written value of the lock in question in the elided lock buffer instead of the transaction. That's a thing that can be established quite fast, and then the hardware would enter the transactional mode there. So for that core, we would then be in transactional mode. We can then do the ordinary read-write accesses as if in standard transactional mode, just setting the T flag in any case that we access something, and we would then act like in the transactional memory approach whenever we receive something like an invalidate message to the cache line. We would just start over with an X abort, which would then revert the whole thing and just go back to X begin. And same thing for the read message to a modified cache line. And with that, we would rely on the facilities of the transactional memory to be the ones that keep the validity of our transaction intact or restart in case that somebody else is interfering with our computation. So we don't actually need to somehow communicate things like the like the actual lock. The only thing is that in order for that to work, the core needs to pay attention to the MESI bus for actual for mention whether there's messages that mention the lock address itself, as that is of course one thing where we have to abort our transaction. Apart from that, local CPU reads from the address of the elided lock access the elided lock buffer now instead of the cache, so that the this kind of legacy code, which is still thinking that there's something like an actual lock variable out there, is still able to perceive whether the lock is taken or not. So that's where what the elided lock buffer is actually all about. And yeah, then there's the X release, which is pretty similar to the X end, which would just decrement C and clear the T flags and the elided locks buffer, and then just represents a commit. So that's what the lock elision is all about. So in summary, for transactional memory, the global goal for everything is to provide an easy way of implementing atomic blocks in our code for just general purpose code. we don't want to be restricted to the details of deadlock prevention or detection or just having deadlocks all in all. And also we don't have want to think about the actual expressivity of things that I want to execute atomically. So that's what the atomic blocks are all about. And we have seen that that's a quite convenient way of programming concurrently with communication in a safe way. And there are several ways of implementing that. We can just use software solution on common older hardware that would refer to locks for implementing that, or we might use on more modern hardware the hardware features that are offered for that. Of course, there's a lot of special things that come with transactional memories, especially the topic of mixing non-TM code with either software or hardware transactional memory. That's, of course, a certain issue. So depending on what's actually used there, there might be conflicts or not. There's a certain charming aspect about the restricted transactional memory approach that we have seen, that in the sense that it actually is a strong isolation approach, as the non-transactional code would trigger just the abortion of the transaction that are realized with the RTM implementation. So that's something that you don't get as easy as that with just a software solution, as you have to explicitly instrument the code when it reads from shared references. And for non-transactional memory code, well, you would also have to kind of keep track of all the memory addresses which are accessed in some software transactional memory transactions, and pay attention that all the accesses to that are outside of transactions are somehow triggering the software transactions to abort. And yeah, that's just a mess. Or, well, you just define that you don't have a strong isolation in that part. Okay, when we have seen some kind of issues that arise with single lock atomicity and transactional sequential consistency, so that's a question of what model is actually applied, and, well, that is the one that we see in action for the hardware transactional memory part, so that's probably the one to take away from here. So for the implicit HTM, what you have to keep in mind is that the restricted transactional memory needs a fallback path. It's a finite resources approach, so the free composition that you actually aimed for when thinking about these atomic blocks from over here, with the composition as the design principle, actually hits kind of a natural boundary here, in that the transactional memory that's provided from the hardware is actually a restricted one. Thus, you need to have some kind of a fallback path in which the hardware transactional implementation just doesn't support you. So you need to come up with such a thing yourself. There's just no progress guarantee, especially in cases where you just loop through your transactions until they finally succeed. So in these cases, you might still end up with kind of a life lock. When your transactions just keep aborting each other, for example, if you don't have something like a fallback path. And what you've also seen is that The common pattern of lock elision can be something that's hard, that can be hardware accelerated or supported, and that's just a small addendum to the bog standard restricted transactional memory approach. In practice, for transactional memory implementations, what can you use to get access to that? Well, that's still a pretty new feature, all in all. And turns out that there's not too many hardware platforms that have working transactional memory extensions out there. We had slides that told about the first implementations turning up in 2014. However, turned out that the implementation in there was faulty, and a few firmware updates to your BIOS and operating system later, the whole extension thing has been deactivated for these early implementations of transactional memory. So this 2014 is still not the the time that you need your laptop have been bought or something in order to be able to actually try the whole system out. So yeah, I think it's only the very latest generations of CPUs that are actually have a working transactional memory implementation in there. I wonder, has anyone tried to access transactional memory on his or her machine out there? Is there anyone who has successfully found out that this gear is able to no? No one at all? Well, we have to show that in the tutorial then how that actually works. Turns out that also in our office there are not too many machines that are new enough to support that, but luckily my second laptop has that. So we can at least play around with that a little bit. So in case that your hardware is capable of that, then what can you use in order to make use of the hardware features? Well, there's GCC, who has been kind of the spearhead of the compilers, except of course for the developer of the hardware themselves, but that is kind of the first larger compiler provider that has support for that, and you can use these transaction atomic regions, or well, that's just the marker for the block, in which you can specify transactions, and with that, the transactions will be dispatched to library, which either implements hardware transactional memory, or if your system doesn't support that, will translate to software transactional memory. So, yeah, depending on your system, that will give you certain performance implications. But with that, you have had ways to access that in the past already. Then, a few months or years later, there has been an ISO standard working group emerged from just nowhere, maybe, that was that talks about extending C++ with transactional memory in a more standardized way, and they're pretty close to the implementation that has been provided in GCC already. Just they've switched to another keyword, so it's not so cryptic anymore with the underscores. So there's since GCC 6.1, you can also alternatively now use this new syntax. There's also a few other features added to the API, so that's things that are here to come. And as the ISO is a pretty well-known standardization committee, I think there's pretty high chances that the proposals that are in there will also meander through the implementations and also reach other compilers out there. So that's probably a thing that, well, I'm not so sure. I don't know. Well, at least there's a standard draft out there already. I think it didn't make it into the newest working versions of the next C++ standard, but well, we'll see. It's still kind of in the making, the whole thing. Yeah, I've also mentioned that libitm has several implementations depending on what your system actually supports, and even the more abstract languages with the virtual machines, like the JDK, for example, also have some way of rudimentary transactional memory support in their monitor implementations, at least by now, and you can enable that on the command line with just another parameter when you start up your virtual machine. So that's also possible. The hardware lock elision is something which at first was quite a promising approach, but I think apart from an article that was mentioning that there was some kind of extension to the libc, at least for GCC, would be proposed that actually uses restricted transactional memory for hardware lock elision would be out there, but I'm not so sure. At least with my experiments, I couldn't really observe something like that in the main branch of the glibc. So, well, I'm not sure whether it still needs time to come or whether they just haven't implemented something like that. For our tutorial, I have just a kind of a manually written thing for that, so yeah. Okay, so all in all, there's a few means of just experimenting with transactional memory, and we will see that on Friday. This is now, or has been now, the last lecture in the sequence that's dealing with concurrent programming. Of course, there are a few other topics out there which haven't been covered in the slides so far. There's, for example, more details on the actor model that made it to a few other languages, specifically Erlang, which is one particular language that's kind of a niche thing, but is dealing with a very large amount of concurrency. And it's quite remarkable that that what you can achieve when choosing such a special purpose tool in terms of the amount of concurrency that you can handle with that. That's a special purpose language for, well, I think it was originally planned for being used in environments where you have communication switches, like I think it was for some telephone companies or something where they have line management or something. But yeah, that was is something that's not mentioned here. Then there's blocking message passing, or PI calculus, which is also has a few special purpose implementations in Occam, Occam Pi, and also one of the upcoming things like Go. So that might also be something of interest in the sense of concurrent programming. And there's also other areas where parallelism is emerging. However, there's a few different parameters in there, like environments where you have restrictions on what you can do, in the sense that they're kind of safety critical. And there's in those systems, there's special preconditions around. For example, there's weird behavior and scheduling that are reflected in the way that you can specify your algorithms. That is this priority ceiling thing over here. This is a certain protocol in how that specifies how the priority of threads can change in order to be able to meet certain deadlines in your code. So that is for some aspects of real-time execution quite interesting, and that has a few consequences on how resources are handled and how process process priorities are all about. So that's also something that might be of interest for some of you. However, due to time reasons, I also have skipped that. But that all those things might offer a few topics for your special projects later on in the year. So that's all from my part for today. Thank you for listening.